And now it's time for the Talk of the Nation opinion page. Last September, Israeli jets bombed a site in northern Syria, but it took 7 months for the Bush administration to confirm that the target was a nearly finished nuclear facility that Syria was building with help from North Korea. Despite that development, senior U.S. intelligence officials say they only have low confidence that Syria wants to build nuclear weapons. In an opinion piece published yesterday in the Los Angeles Times, Leonard Spector and Avner Cohen argue that, quote, when the intelligence community has real evidence, it should not be afraid to draw the obvious inference and call a spade a spade. After all the mistakes in Iraq, they write, the intelligence community has bent over backward to try to overstating the case against Syria, and in doing so, it has stumbled badly. How should we apply the lessons of Iraq to Syria and Iran? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Leonard Spector is Deputy Director of the Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute, and he joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
And you and your co-author draw a stark distinction between two words, fact and inference.
Well, that's right. I think in the case of Iraq, we all can look back and say we had very few facts, and many of them proved to be inaccurate. And then on top of that very modest foundation, we built a huge superstructure based on inference. Saddam had wanted bombs in the past. He'd had programs in the past. Inspectors weren't there. This was the kind of regime that wants these kinds of weapons. And we got into trouble. But in other cases, like the case of Syria now and the case of Iran, we have some very clear facts. And drawing the inference there is not difficult. The facts start to accumulate, and you really need to say, we can't prove it. But the facts are there that make us very, very concerned that this is a nuclear weapon program really in both countries, Syria and in Iran. The Syrian case, you have this reactor, which is virtually a duplicate. It's modeled on the one in Yanbyong, North Korea, that was used by the North Koreans for the production of plutonium for the nuclear weapon they actually set off. Both North Korea and Syria were suffering the same kind of threats in the late 1990s when this seems to have started. They'd lost their Soviet protectors. They were on their own. They were surrounded by some states that were allied with us and were in a hostile environment. And, gee, it's not surprising they began to get together. They were also, Syria was purchasing missiles from North Korea at that time.
Mm-hmm. But some people would look at the case of Iran and say, here's a fact for you. The U.S. intelligence service has just concluded a couple of months ago that Iran is no longer building a nuclear weapon.
Well, that was a second kind of problem, which was another linguistic challenge. They use the term very narrowly. The way most of us think about a nuclear weapons program, it has major components. It has the group that's designing the bomb, a tricky business, but usually one that's done well in advance of the time that a country gets the stuff that goes in the bomb.
That's hard to get.
That's hard to get, and the Iranians are plugging along very aggressively, refusing to slow down despite various international sanctions and resolutions from the UN. And they're also building some very powerful missiles that definitely have nuclear potential. So when you see all of these elements continuing apace, you have a very aggressive leadership in Iran. You're left with the conclusion that this is a nuclear weapons program that's continuing, even if a certain element may have paused at a certain stage for a period of time.
In fact, you conclude in this piece that the release of that key finding that Iran was no longer in the business of designing nuclear weapons, that's specifically referred to, that the release of that information was sort of a bureaucratic bungle and indeed now regretted by the administration.
Well, that's right. Since this happened, senior intelligence officials from all the major intelligence agencies have spoken on camera, on television, or before congressional committees to say that this was an error the way it was presented, and that indeed the situation in Iran is very dangerous for the reasons I stated, the continued support of the uranium enrichment effort and the missile program.
Mm-hmm. Yet there are still questions about Syria, and those include, this might have been a Yanbyong-type reactor, but there was no reprocessing facility nearby. You can't get the plutonium out unless you reprocess it nearby.
Right, so the right reaction is, they're there. We haven't found them yet because no one's going to build a reactor like this, which clearly had only one purpose, and not get those other facilities underway. So my sense is that this was not just a lark by the Assads to build a nice facility in the desert. This had a real purpose. And as more comes out, I imagine we're going to find some of the other pieces, a stockpile of fuel perhaps provided by North Korea, some other kind of a way of extracting the plutonium. So I don't think the whole story is out yet, and I have a feeling it's not going to be benign as we hear more about it.
One of the reasons everybody suspects that Iran is developing a nuclear weapon is nuclear power. This is a country that sits on enormous reserves of oil and gasoline, and oil and natural gas, rather, and can pretty much fuel its own energy needs for the future. They don't particularly need nuclear power. Syria is not so blessed.
Syria has some oil, but the way to go, the next step is not to start with a big nuclear energy program, especially a North Korean-designed one. I mean, this is a country whose own domestic electric production from nuclear energy is kind of a joke. If you really wanted to do it right, you'd start with one of the major powers, like, let's say, Russia, or not the United States, I don't think, and you'd actually try to see if you could have a standard nuclear power plant constructed with all the trimming supplied from the outside. The UAE, by the way, is adopting this approach very explicitly. None of the sensitive facilities in-country, all of the sensitive activities conducted outside by major well-known players, and then they'll have a limited nuclear energy program that just produces electricity as their own oil reserves decline in coming years.
Let's get a caller on the line. And by the way, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Our guest is Leonard Sandy Spector on the opinion page this week. Dave joins us on the line from Massachusetts.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I guess my question is really pretty simple, and it is, why should we believe you? You say you have facts but can't prove anything. The Syrian nuclear thing that Israel doesn't even acknowledge the event occurred. And with all of that, combined with Iraq and everything else, why should we believe you? And that's my question. And I'll take the answer off air.
Dave, thanks for the call.
Well, first of all, it's a perfectly good question, and it's one that I have to really think through myself every day. What happens is we deal with the evidence in front of us. Here we have a very elaborate video provided by the U.S. government with a good deal of detail, some very compelling photographs taken in the reactor during construction and afterwards, photographs taken by satellite as the reactor was dismantled so that you could see some of the major elements of the reactor, and the comparison made to the one in North Korea. So I think we have to sort of make judgments. Now, Israel would not have done this lightly. They know the consequences of taking on Syria, and the potential there was either for Syria to retaliate with a missile, maybe with chemical weapons, or to have Hezbollah start something attacking Israel from southern Lebanon. So this was not undertaken in a light fashion, and I think I'm drawing the inferences based on this evidence as to where we are. But do I have the facts? Have I been there to see them? Have I talked to the North Koreans? The answer is no.
Leonard Spector, of the Deputy Director of the Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies, author, co-author with Avner Cohen of Cloak and Stagger, which appeared in the Los Angeles Times over the weekend. We have a link to the piece on our website. You can see it at npr.org/blogofthenation. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another David on the line. This is David calling us from Downingtown in Pennsylvania.
Hello. I'm wondering whether it was the White House that maybe got the intelligence wrong the first time around rather than the intelligence community. I'm pretty serious about that question, and I'll take my answer off the air.
David, thank you.
Well, I think we're all sort of going back over this period and appreciate that there was a certain enthusiasm for a certain viewpoint in the White House. And some of the evidence clearly was not accurate. But in some cases, it was the intelligence community itself that was spoofed. We have Curveball, who was feeding this information in about some of the WMD activities in Iraq, through the Germans and others. And we simply, that is to say, the intelligence community, misunderstood or mischaracterized what it was seeing, and it overplayed its hand. Again, I think because of the expectations we had about the behavior of Saddam Hussein. So we allowed ourselves, some more than others, to take a very small database and build from it. But in these other cases, I think we have stronger cases to make based on the facts that are at hand. And I don't think we want to shrink from at least going the step of saying we aren't certain, but we can sure infer that this looks like a nuclear weapons program, and we have to treat it as though it is one and try to bend our efforts to stop it as fast as we can.
Do you think that there was, to some degree, a pendulum at work here? After the first Gulf War, U.S. experts realized they had missed a lot of what was going on in Iraq, including two additional nuclear weapons programs they did not know about. And that then when before the second Gulf War, they said, well, we were fooled last time. We won't get burned again. And that this time they said, well, we were wrong last time, and now we won't get burned again.
Well, that's exactly correct. And, you know, on the positive side, as I understand it, the classified version of the Iran National Intelligence Estimate is very subtly done. It's very complete and it's very balanced. People have told me who have read it. So in that sense, the intelligence community is trying to get it precise. The release of the unclassified version messed things up because of certain restrictions on what they could release and how they had to present it. But you're correct. There is this effort to try to find the middle ground. And I think what Avner Cohn and I were concerned about is that they haven't quite got it right. They need a couple of good editors, frankly, to just get the phrasing in a way that we all understand it obviously and immediately when we read these documents.
Let's talk with Chuck. Chuck calling us from San Francisco.
Thanks very much. Just first of all, I think that the answer to the last question really kind of avoided what I thought were the facts, that the CIA was extremely skeptical about Curveball and all of the intelligence that was being funneled from the
They were skeptical
INC.
Of some, but not all. I think that's fair to say.
Well, I read a Senate...
Chuck, let's move on. We're running out of time here.
Sorry. I think one lesson we need to learn is that we shouldn't place too much emphasis on the intelligence to the point that we overlook the more important strategic and policy questions of, well, even if there is some element of truth to this intelligence, what's the best way to deal with the fact that the Non-Proliferation Treaty, for example, is in a very decrepit state right now, and aren't there perhaps better ways to deal with these threats than just going off and bombing other countries every time we think they may be starting to develop a program?
Fair point, Leonard Spector.
Well, I think that's right. We need the treaty. It certainly serves as a basis for all of the diplomacy that we try to bring to bear in a case like North Korea or Iran. You couldn't just do it out of the blue. You need a kind of underpinning of international support for nonproliferation. So it's really the crucial foundation. Going off and bombing something goes, you know, absolutely against the grain of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. On the other hand, you know, there was a stark choice. Did Israel want to confront another Iran where this situation could drag on indefinitely and Syria might actually get a capability that could be so threatening to Israel, or would it strike at the early time?
And there's also, no matter what you're doing, you need credible intelligence, and credible is important.
Well, that's correct. So, you know, I don't want to say I bless or endorse what happened, but I can understand what happened because all decision makers, both in the United States and in Israel, were facing this other alternative of the slow slog at the UN against Iran, which did not seem to be making progress at the time.
Leonard Spector, again, thank you for your time. Leonard Spector of the Center for Nonproliferation Studies, the Monterey Institute, co-author with Avner Cohen of Cloak and Stagger in the Los Angeles Times. Again, you can find a link to that on our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. This is NPR News.